You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a quick heads up, Ben Zucker, Eric Lochte from the Occupy DC movement, which may at this moment be under assault, as it were, the Park Police. Daryl Issa, the only former criminal in the U.S. Congress, has for about a year now been, a little less than a year, aggressively agitating from the United States Congress, since the District of Columbia is under the control of Congress, agitating to get the Occupy movement people kicked out. And so those of you listening to us on the two stations that carry us live in the Washington, D.C. area, AM 1480 We Act Radio, WPWC, and also AM 1390 here in Washington, D.C. Those of you listening to us on either station, if you have any updates or if you know what's going on, let us know. We will also be checking in with the Talk Radio News Service on that. Over the weekend, the big story, what happened with the Occupy movement out on the West Coast on Saturday and then Sunday with 27, I believe it is, sympathy, as it were, strikes or movements across the country. And for that, Susie Cagle is with us. She's a freelance journalist and contributor to The Guardian, the progressive newspaper out of the UK. GuardianNews.com is the website. Susie, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So were you in Oakland, Susie?
I was. I'm actually a resident of Oakland, so I was out in the street on the 28th all day.
Okay, so tell us what happened.
Oh, goodness. It kicked off with a march toward a vacant building that Occupy Oakland had planned to take over and turn into a political and community center, replacing what was lost when those tent camps were raided back in the fall. Mm-hmm. And police were just not going to let that happen that day. They blockaded Occupy from every direction, and every possible plan B, plan C, plan D building that they might have wanted to take. Police were just not going to let them do it. And it ended up in I think more than 400 arrests in a mass crackdown.
Was the rationale for this that it's illegal to squat in property that you don't own or that you don't have a permit from the city to use, that kind of thing?
Yeah, trespassing.
Yeah.
And the first building that Occupy had planned to take is actually city-owned and has been out of use for 6 years now. It's for sale. The city would like someone to buy it. It's a huge, majestic 100-year-old auditorium.
Yeah.
That used to be home to all sorts of public events. Both a really useful and also symbolic, I think, building for Occupy.
I'm assuming that the official rationale for not simply saying, sure, come on in, is that the city would then take liability for that and they have no idea the condition of the building, quack, quack, quack.
Absolutely.
Could they not have simply turned their face the other way, just ignored it, or is that was there? I guess the bigger question is, did the city of Oakland have an alternative in their mind and in your mind, for that matter, to saying, no, wait a minute, you got to do this, get a bunch of donors and rent a building or something like that?
The city of Oakland tried to get Occupy into a building back in November, at least a part of Occupy. They were interested in moving it in that direction, and that was something spearheaded by Gene Kwan's husband, actually, as his own personal project. But Occupy wasn't really having it. I think that part of this act is that they want to take this building. They're reclaiming the commons and the building that used to be used for the public good and is owned by the city. Occupy feels they have claim to it. The building is in some disrepair, the city would take liability. Personally, I think that was not the building to take that day. I think that there were other strategies and other buildings. Oakland has tons of foreclosed vacant buildings that,
sure,
that could be home to Occupy and may be home to Occupy in the coming weeks.
That might be up to code right now where the city wouldn't have that excuse, at least.
Right.
I understand 400 people were arrested. The police were using flashbang grenades and this sort of thing. And then also that there was a small contingent of the popularly in the press, they're referred to as anarchists, of people who are actually out there smashing things. And the picture, of course, in the newspapers today is the burned flag and the smashed building at the city hall, which is not even near this area. So, you know, what's the story with all that?
Well, when police really moved in for the big mass arrests, it was very confusing. There was no dispersal order, and everyone was really in a kettle. They could not get out, and that included myself and five other journalists. We were all swept up in that, and many people escaped outside through a YMCA. It was reported that people had charged and stormed the YMCA, broke into the YMCA, but actually they pleaded to the YMCA employees to let them in and let them escape, and the YMCA opened their doors. And so people, about 100 people, 200 people escaped through the YMCA and went down to City Hall. And I was not there. I was in plastic handcuffs at the time. But I heard from others that when they got to City Hall, the doors to City Hall were actually open. They were propped open. I was not there. I can't confirm this, but I've heard this from many people. And some people said, don't go in. It's a trap. And other people went right into City Hall, did that damage that we're seeing in the papers today, and is much discussed destroying of children's art and the burning of the American flag. But that standoff was relatively short-lived, and it was at the end of a long day of street battles and a pretty violent kettling and mass arrests just north of them, north in town.
Yeah. There was back in the 60s, there was a split in the civil rights movement and in the anti-war movement, for that matter, between whether the SDS and the Weather Underground, and in the civil rights movement between the organizations supported by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and a whole long list of different alphabet soup organizations, and smaller kind of offshoot organizations about whether or not violence should be used, that violence gets press attention, which is what changes public opinion. If you don't use violence, you don't get press attention, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems like the nonviolent groups in both cases carried the day with those movements. Is there, to what extent is that debate going on right now in the Occupy Oakland group? Or is it not even a debate? Are the people who are doing the violence just, you know, not even engaging the rest of the occupiers in a dialogue about it and just going off and doing it?
There used to be a debate. That was something that was much discussed back in October and November. And the Occupy Oakland just could not really come to a consensus. So it seemed to me that about 85% to 90% of Occupy at that time really did believe in a nonviolent approach, a civil disobedient direct action, but nonviolent and non-vandalizing approach.
Go ahead.
So I think that lack of consensus at that time, that perceived lack of consensus, drove a lot of those nonviolent people away from Occupy Oakland. There just a week and a half ago, there was a big action in San Francisco to shut down downtown San Francisco and the financial district, and people chained themselves to banks. It was very direct action, civil disobedience, and very different from Oakland.
Right.
And it was interesting to see what a big difference there was just 10 miles across the bridge.
Right, but even there's a spectrum. I mean, there's a difference between civil disobedience and vandalism. So, yeah. Anyway, Susie Cagle with GuardianNews.com, writing for The Guardian. Susie, thanks for the update and for the story from the ground.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you. I do appreciate your being on our program. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more about what happened in the Occupies over the weekend, and also amazing news coming out of the next Republican hostage taking.
We want jobs.
Occupying the airwaves, the Tom Hartman Program, and for those of you listening to our, of course, we're broadcasting nationwide, coast to coast, on Pacifica stations, on commercial stations from New York to Los Angeles, on XM Sirius, on as television, on Free Speech TV, on DirecTV, on Dish Network, on both satellite systems, both satellite radio systems, both satellite TV systems, all that kind of stuff. But for those of you listening in Washington, D.C., on the two stations here in D.C. that carry our show, WZHF 1390 AM and WPWC 1480 AM, special heads up, D.C. is under assault. Eric Lotke is with us. He is a participant in Occupy D.C. He's also a writer and author of 2044. The big problem isn't Big Brother, it's Big Brother, Inc. The website for that is 2044thenovel.com. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hello there.
So what's going on right now?
Right now I'm sitting here at McPherson Square. It's a beautiful day. And the occupiers just put a banner over this, a giant tarp over a statue, the statue of the general in the middle of the square. And it says Tent of Dreams. And it's as big as the statue. It's a whole thing covering the horse as if a poncho, but a little hole so the general's head can pop out. And they're chanting.
So, back when this went before the Supreme Court, and what was that, about 10, 12 years ago, something like that, the Supreme Court ruled that people could be in public areas in Washington, D.C. overnight, and that did constitute free speech, as long as they didn't sleep. And so the park police are saying, you guys can have tents, you guys can be there, you just can't have sleeping bags there and you can't sleep there. Is the Occupy movement in D.C. inclined, either one of them, McPherson Square or Liberty Plaza, inclined to go along with that Supreme Court decision, or have the police said, to hell with the Supreme Court decision, we're going to do it a different way? What's going on?
All of the tents that were here yesterday are still here. Mm-hmm. I saw one very clever gentleman who opened up the flap of his tent. And he put a little teddy bear in there, postured it as if it's reading a book. And he said, when the cops come by at midnight, that's all they will see is my teddy bear reading the book.
Right.
Individually, people will do what they will do as a movement. There's no sense of we are leaving around here. Everybody, this public spirit is stand and fight. Every individual will make their own decisions. And we'll see as the evening goes on. Exactly as you say, the order is you can't sleep there starting at noon. Well, here it is noon. Nobody's sleeping because we don't expect them to.
Right, which means that they'll probably move in after it gets dark like they tend to in other places around the country.
Right.
There's not as many cameras, not as many people.
Exactly right. Tonight, no cameras. And the other tactical decision by the police is, one by one, we will check your tent, and if you are in there and you are sleeping or there's a sleeping bag, we will take you away.
And presumably trash the sleeping bag.
And presumably trash the sleeping bag and the tent. And this goes back to, every individual can make their own decision, but what's going on tactically is very much of a divide and conquer, not coming in with hundreds of officers to arrest hundreds of people all at once, sweep style, which invites media coverage of pepper spray. So
right.
One by one, they'll take people out of their tents if those who are in their tents tonight.
Right. And what's the latest on the situation between McPherson Square and Liberty Plaza, two different Occupy locations, and the mayor's suggestion that they should be lumped together? And then, of course, now we've got Congress, Dara Issa, the only criminal in Congress, former criminal in Congress. Okay. Who for months now has been agitating to get rid of you guys and is a fairly powerful Republican and worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The richest criminal in Congress, too, but he actually has a criminal past. What's the deal with all that?
People are talking about it. The McPherson folks and the Freedom Plaza folks, as I'm guessing you know, they're independent occupations, different personalities, different histories, in the same spirit and doing the same thing, just camped on different pieces of real estate. And they've been talking to each other for weeks, and they're talking to each other in a more urgent way right now. There could be some logic to shutting down McPherson and having tents moved to Freedom Plaza. It could well be that way. Every camper will make their own decision about where they want to be.
Okay.
And we'll see as a movement what happens. What's more important than anything is that the movement stays alive and the movement grows beyond the camps. And the movement is more than just the people who sleep in the tents. The movement is bigger than any of that.
Sure.
And you got the heroic souls at McPherson, the heroic souls at Freedom, and they might well end up consolidating, and maybe that will work well.
Right. So, Eric, I'm curious. We're talking with Eric Lotke. And I would perfectly well understand. Here we are, you know, on air in front of God and the whole world. If you said you have made up your mind, or you're just going to keep your own counsel. But do you want to talk about your own personal decision and those of the people that you're close to?
Well, I'm personally different. I'm not a sleeper. I am not staying here. That's part of my role in the movement. Mm-hmm. Is I'm a part timer. I have a full time job with healthcare. I'm doing just fine, thank you. I'm a member of my school PTA. I have kids. And one of the reasons I started coming out here months ago by now and bringing them food and bringing them support in all different kinds of ways is because the 99% is more than the purple-haired hippies who you see on TV.
Sure.
I love the purple-haired hippies, but it's more than just that. What can I do in the movement? And the answer is I can bring them bagels, I can bring them food, I can give them a little bit of money, and I can support them in all of these ways, and I can explain them back to my other suburban PTA parents saying, well, what is this? What is it that they want? Why are they doing this? And so I can be an ambassador in that way.
That's marvelous. And more people need to be doing that.
Here, though.
More people need to be doing that all over the country, is showing up at the Occupy movements and saying, I'm here. How can I support? How can I help out? Even if they can't camp or be there or overnight or whatever and all that kind of thing. Eric, you've given me a pretty good overview of what's going on. I think we have about, well, we don't. There we go. I thought we had 30 seconds. But, Eric, thanks so much for being with us. I do appreciate your call and giving us the update. And let's stay in touch, okay?
Thank you for all that you do.
Okay, Eric. And you can check out Eric's personal work at 2044thenovel.com. And Eric Lockett. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The Occupy movement under assault all across the nation. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the news from the weekend. More right after this in your calls.
Welcome to the U.S. occupation. To win the hearts and minds. Defend all humankind. Tell the banks and the corporations. We're here to occupy the
Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast and all around the planet. Ben Zucker with OccupyDC.org is on the line with us. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Is Zuccotti Park or Liberty Square?
I'm here at McPherson Square right now.
McPherson Square. Pardon me.
Amazing.
Yeah, McPherson Square. Okay. This is Occupy DC, and the word came down that today noon was the deadline. Of course, it was all about whether or not you guys are sleeping there, so I'm guessing nothing's going to happen until it's dark and sleeping time. You're a tenter, right? You're one of the people who's actually staying there and sleeping there.
Yes, I tent when I can.
Okay. So has any kind of consensus emerged yet from the McPherson Square Occupy DC group about whether or not they're going to just sit up wide awake all night and do away with the sleeping bags? Or, and keep the tents open to conform with the park rules, or whether they're going to defy those rules and get arrested. What's going to happen in your mind?
Well, the scene here at the camp right now is pretty exciting. There are hundreds, if not over 1,000 folks here, or hundreds of people there. And we've built a giant tent around General McPherson in the middle. We're calling it our Tent of Dreams, representing the dreams of the movement, the dream of the end of corporate money and politics, the dream of everyone being able to have health care and a place to live and food on their table. It's really actually a very exciting scene right now in McPherson Square. The general feeling around is that we plan on defending our right to be in the place, and then obviously some folks have moved out their bedding and such. I think those are the things that the Park Service was most interested in not seeing here anymore, but this is a really great gathering of our community. I think this is the most folks we've had out at McPherson.
That's great. That's great. And let me encourage our listeners on AM 1480, WPWC here in WDC in Washington DC, and also AM 1390 here in WDC in Washington DC to who are both listening to us live at this moment. To get out and help you show up at McPherson Square and pitch in. And, our listeners on XM and Sirius and Free Speech TV and DirecTV and Dish Network and blah, 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 blah. We had a conversation earlier with one of the folks who is participating there, who suggested that some in the movement see this enforcement of the old Supreme Court decision that said that on federal property, it is not illegal. It is free speech to be there 24/7. However, when somebody's sleeping, they're not free speeching, and that's not a form of free speech. And therefore, presumably, you know, the police are going to come in when people try to sleep. And that that this is seen now as a divide and conquer effort to force people within the Occupy movement to decide, are we going to sleep or are we not going to sleep? And of course, there's going to be a variety of opinions. What are your thoughts on that? First of all, you know, as an analysis of a strategic plan on the other side, and B, how's that going to play out?
I think it's a systematic approach to, you know, continuing the oppression of the state on the folks out here. But really, sleeping in the park is simply a tactic in this movement. We have, you know, we're organizing in all different types of ways. And then whether or not we're allowed to sleep in a park in the middle of downtown D.C., people are still going to be having conversations in their living rooms out in Maryland and Virginia. You know, people are still going to be, you know, preventing foreclosures. People are still going to be, you know, being critical of their government and protesting when necessary. And this is, you know, one excellent protest, you know, being able to sleep in the public park and be able to create this giant camp.
Mm-hmm. So with Daryl Issa, the only, to the best of my knowledge, the only member of Congress with a criminal past, although he is a multimillionaire and one of those powerful Republicans in the House, agitating really, really strongly, leaning on the park police to come after you guys if you're sleeping. Has there been any, I'm sure that this is a subject of ongoing discussion in your general assemblies, has there been any consensus about what y'all are going to do tonight?
I mean, well, right now the plan is we have this, like, I'm telling you, you should, if any of your listeners can go, even just search Occupy DC Ustream, and you'll be able to see the action live for what's going on. We
okay.
have a huge tent, like a lot of people here are committed to defending the space. I don't believe that the Park Service is, you know, has even made any move towards us not being allowed to, you know, be here or protest here. It seemed to me when I watched the you can also see the congressional hearing where ISA and Alan Holmes Norton, DC's representative, and the people from the Park Police and the Department of Health spoke, that the people from the Park Police really weren't interested in seeing us, you know, leaving the park in any way.
Yeah, they would just as soon not have a fight. I mean, you know, unlike apparently the police in Oakland, who we spoke with
right.
earlier. We didn't speak with the police. We spoke with one of the occupiers in Oakland.
That was terrible. That was really an incredible scene to watch on film.
It really was. It really was. And the other thing I noticed is that there wasn't, at least, I mean, I'm not an all-consuming news junkie. I can't claim to have watched every single news program on every single network all weekend long, but I consume a fair amount of news media. I mean, this is the business that I'm in. I have no choice. And I saw no mainstream media coverage, basically, of what's going on with the Occupy movement over the weekend. And it occurred to me that had a Tea Party shown up someplace, and Sarah Palin flown in to give a speech, and suddenly 400 people got arrested, that it would have been worldwide news. It would have been at the top, screaming top of Drudge. All the networks would have been there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you guys have the sense that there's a news blackout?
I don't feel like there's a news blackout. I just think that, you know, we're fighting an uphill battle, and, you know, the Tea Party is an entrenched in the Republican Party. It's a very, you know, much working within the system, and then we're committed to working without it. I honestly think that the Occupy movement is able to have more impact on the political discourse of this country by not working within the system. You know, the Tea Party is seen as an enemy to many, and the Occupy movement is seen as an ally to the 99%. We're really, you know, like talking about, you know, getting corruption out of politics, and we're really talking about income inequality in a way that's really resonating with people. It's resonating in the, you know, the GOP debates. It's resonating in, you know, Obama's rhetoric. It's exciting. I really think we're making a difference.
Yeah. Well said, Ben. Ben, thanks a lot for the call.
All right. Thank you
and
so much.
Great to hear from you. Say hi to everybody down there for us. And, you know, if anything's going on, anything happening, you know our number. Give us a shout, and we'll continue the conversation on the air.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much.
Great. Thanks a lot. Ben Zucker, OccupyDC.org, the website of participant Occupy DC. Michael in K-Talk in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk in Los Angeles. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, let me ask you a question. You bring up the Tea Party thing. You know, the Tea Party, did you know how much it costs in Oakland for all this disturbance that they've created? $5 million it's cost to the city of Oakland to for the police and all this other stuff. I don't see the Tea Party.
Michael, have you figured out how much it costs for the banksters to rob us blind?
Oh, come on, Tom. This is a dead serious question, Michael.
People are standing up saying, listen, I'm sick and tired of being ripped off by the banksters. And then you're calling up going, oh, gee, well, the banksters might have stolen a few billion or a few hundred billion, and they're just doing fine, thank you very much, in their mansions. But a few people showed up to argue about it, and it cost $5 million, which is like maybe half an hour of the city's budget, and we're all upset. Michael, you've been listening to too much right-wing talk radio. I'm sorry. It is... If that's your argument, that's the most pathetic argument I've ever heard. Rick in Phoenix. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Oh, Tom.
Yeah.
Who was that guy? I mean, people like that just chap my hide.
Well, yeah. He's not here to defend himself, so I'm not going to continue going off on him.
Know,
but,
Tom,
you know,
nice
thanks
guy,
for listening to KPHX in Phoenix, Rick. What's on your mind?
I'm a big Occupy supporter. But my question was, how long has Congress been able to get in on those insider trader deals? Is that been going
apparently
on
for forever.
And,
apparently
yeah,
forever.
I mean,
apparently it became a fad among Republicans when Tom DeLay was running the House, and Brian Baird was the first guy who blew the whistle on it about 3-4 years ago, and the Democrats, you know, when he notified the Democrats of what was going on in Tom DeLay's office, apparently there were a number of Republicans that were aggressively doing this and making a whole lot of money on the side. And the Democrats, you know, tried to ban it. Nancy Pelosi actually pushed through the House legislation to ban it. But it took that 60 Minutes special, I think. And now the president in his State of the Union address saying, let's put an end to this to make it happen. But this has always been something that the Republicans have embraced and the Democrats have been pretty broadly horrified by. So,
I hope the bill goes through. I hope they pass it.
I think it will. If it doesn't, it's a big black eye for Congress, and they don't want that. Rick, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to Phoenix. Aaron in Malibu. Hey, Aaron, what's up?
I just wanted to have you clarify what you were talking about when you were talking about violence.
Right.
When people speak about damaging property and damaging humans, I think that we need to make a distinction.
I think that we do. On the other hand, I think that there are three things going on. One is, you know, normal, whatever you call it, you know, protest within the law. The second is protest outside the law that is totally nonviolent, that as Martin Luther King practiced. Even though it's outside the law, that is, it's generally violating things like trespass laws, it's nonviolent. And the third is vandalism, breaking property. The fourth, of course, is what you're mentioning, harming other people. And I would say that fourth is what the police in some cases are guilty of. The third, gratuitously damaging property, burning the American flag in the city hall. Those are the things that are being done by people who think that that's what's going to get them in the headlines and that's going to move the movement forward. And I think, frankly, it's going to hurt the movement over the long term. But we'll see. Does that make sense, Aaron?
Even Gandhi believed in damaging property from time to time.
You'll have to give me a citation on that.
Oh, I thought you were a student of Gandhi. Yes, there are many times when there was property damage.
Okay.
You're listening, Aaron, to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Aaron, I'm sure somebody in the chat room will pass that along to me, and it may well be. If that's the case, I stand corrected.
Your money spent to circumvent the people's intent. You jack the rent, cause dissent, cause you broke our sacred covenant. Our papa tents will pound cement, won't back down, no, we won't relent.
Again, just to be very, very clear, my position on this is, you know, when I was asking the various occupiers here at D.C., where they've been told that they can occupy the park, but they can't sleep in the park, and when I was asking them whether or not they were going to sleep in the park, I disagree with the Supreme Court decision, and I'm going to have to dig through and find out exactly what it was and when it was and where it was. I thought I had it. No, I don't. Anyhow, I'll get it during the break here, during the news break. But there was a Supreme Court decision back 15, 20, 25 years ago that said that on federal property, occupying federal property as a way of making a statement was protected speech, but sleeping on it was not. I disagree. I consider sleeping on property as much an act. It is an act. That if it's an act that is done for the purposes of trying to change politics, political, you know, the political dialogue in America, it's a political act. And if it's a political act, it is political speech. Now, similarly, for instance, the Supreme Court has argued that burning the American flag, for example, is a protected act of free speech. That is an act. That's not. There's no words coming out of your mouth. In fact, obscenely, the Supreme Court has ruled that the Koch brothers, having millions and millions of dollars, it's not property that they own. It's speech that they own. I mean, if their money is speech, then sleeping in a park is speech. So just for the record, if anybody misunderstood me, I was just curious how the occupiers were going to deal with this, whether they were going to defy the Supreme Court and the law, which is now the law of the land, or not. And it looks like there's not a clear consensus yet. We'll see how that all plays out and where it goes. James in Franklin, Tennessee. Hey, James, what's up?
Thank you, Tom. I was just going to add a little comment to that, what you're talking about there. If they chose to take and go with the people instead of a police state, they wouldn't have all that expense. And sure. I know for this is a fact. In Nashville, Tennessee, we asked for police protection because we was having problems with the homeless within the encampment on stealing and starting fights and doing drugs in the encampment. And they told us that they couldn't afford to give us police protection, but yet they brought in right at 100 state troopers and lined them up all the way around the plaza and ran us out and arrested people. Yes, they did. And it cost a bunch of money. And we didn't have that many state troopers in our area. So they had to bring these state troopers in, put them in hotels overnight.
Amazing.
See, all of this is part of that cost.
Yeah, now that's because those...
And they're trying to blow this thing up here. And that's why they're running it, like everything with government does. They run it up and then blame it on us.
Well, it's not just government. It's what you're looking at is that when people, you know, when there's a legitimate purpose of government, frankly, which is, you know, dealing with crime. I mean, you know, person-to-person crime, theft and things like that. They're saying, I'm sorry, we're broke. You know, this is like the Republican mantra. But as soon as it is a group of people coming out and protesting against the banksters, oh, no, we're here to protect the banksters. We can't have you protest against the banksters. We're going to shut you down and nail you to the wall. And that's what you're laying out, James. Thank you very much for the call. The Supreme Court case, by the way, was in 1984. It's Clark versus Community for Creative Nonviolence. And in that Supreme Court case, the court ruled that occupying federal property for 24 hours is a protected form of speech, but sleeping during that time is not. And I don't get the difference. And I think, frankly, this is a case that needs to be revisited by the Supreme Court. You know, we'll see. Jackie in Napa, California. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you. I've been thinking about this, about the Occupy in Oakland, since Quan did it the first time with these policemen.
Sure.
That these occupiers are the only ones that's securing our police forces employment.
Ha!
They are the only
job creators
we got right now. And these cops, instead of shooting at them with rubber bullets and busting them in the head with canister grenades, ought to be shaking their hands and thanking them and enjoying a meal with them.
Yeah, because they're... Because of them, those cops are getting the overtime pay, and they've got a job.
That's
excellent
right.
point,
That's
Jackie.
Right.
Excellent job. Excellent point. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Bob in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for the great work that you do. I just wanted to say about money and how our tax dollars are spent and what's going on. Is in September, Brian Williams had an article on the news, on the nightly news. It was 20 seconds, brother, 20 seconds, and it was a GAO report about Afghanistan and Iraq, that $60 billion has been wasted and fraudulently used, slash stolen, in my opinion.
Right.
So that's one thing. And the other thing is on money and the type of economy we're living through. I think we're living through mafia capitalism, where when you saw in the Goodfellas where the mafia's been doing this for years, they get a hold of a company, they run up the stock, they take all the money, they sell all the stock. It's called the bust out.
Yeah.
What I think we're living through is that the corporations in this country figured out they can't just do it one corporation at a time. They can do it with the whole economy, and that's what they're doing. And we have lived through right now, the workers and the taxpayers in this country, the greatest theft in the history of mankind.
And this is how Mitt Romney made his money, by the way, and why he made $40 million over the last 2 years, and he's paying about 15% income tax on it and 0.1% or less in payroll taxes, whereas the average worker pays almost a little less than 8% in payroll taxes. I mean, it is it's absolutely incredible. Well said, Bob. Thank you very much. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that early on in the Occupy movement and at Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street, it came up that people had the freedom to assemble, And that was overruled by a judge, but I still think that people have the freedom to assemble, and so therefore, in order to assemble and do what they need to do to accomplish their free speech, they have to have things with them, which was prevented by the New York Police Department, and also they destroyed a lot of their property. And I also wanted to make a comment about the Republicans and their idea of democracy, and I think their idea of democracy, they equate democracy with unbridled capitalism, but we know that you can have unbridled capitalism in societies that are rather undemocratic, like, for instance, China. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'd like to say.
Yeah, thank you very much. And there are a number of countries around the world that demonstrate that there is a clear difference between democracy and capitalism. And yet, you've got libertarians, Republicans, right-wingers of all stripes. In fact, we're going to hear from one in an hour from now, Jesse Eisinger, who... Mick Gillespie of Reason.com, one of these guys who actually believes that somehow capitalism and democracy, or capitalism and good government, are the same thing. It should be a very interesting conversation. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And news about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, well, Fannie Mae specifically, this is absolutely mind-boggling. And let me get Michael Hudson in here, who has been following this very, very closely with the Center for Public Integrity, iWatchNews.org, the website. Michael Hudson, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Tell us, what's the deal here? Freddie Mac, which is supposed to be backstopping banks, my understanding of this, if this is correct, is supposed to be backstopping banks so that they can loan out money to homeowners and they can refi and things like that, that they've been actually betting against those homeowners?
Right. This comes from a story by Jesse Eisinger at ProPublica and Chris Arnold at National Public Radio, two really great reporters that I've worked with in the past. They have a story that says that Freddie Mac, which is, you know, taxpayer-owned, has made multi-billion-dollar bets that will pay off only if homeowners stay trapped in overpriced mortgages with interest rates well above the current rates.
Right.
So, and this is also happening at the same time that the company was making it harder for homeowners to get out of these kinds of high interest mortgages. And you may recall that both Fannie and Freddie were, despite all their problems, were given a key role by the Obama administration and the Obama plan for refinancing and modifying mortgages, which has turned out to be sort of a near total failure.
Now, Just to clarify for our listeners and for me, frankly, do a reality check with me on this. My understanding is that in 1938, Fannie Mae was created to basically, backstop banks that wanted to give mortgages because Roosevelt had, in 35, as I recall, created a program because the banks were just, in shambles, where the government was actually loaning out money, and the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, Fannie Mae would backstop it so FHA could actually loan out more. They'd have a little leverage there. And then that was expanded in the 40s, in 44, to include VA loans. And that in 68, Lyndon Johnson, because of the cost of the Vietnam War, was looking for federal programs he could take off the books and basically privatized Fannie Mae. He established it as a private shareholder-owned company. And that, as a private shareholder-owned company, it suddenly got into the let's make money on this and started paying its CEOs a whole lot more, particularly after the Reagan era. And then when they blew up in 2007, 2008, 2009 as a result of the Bush Great Depression, they went into basically receivership. The government took them over, but the government doesn't really own them yet. Do I have all that right? Does that make sense?
Right. Well, I think the government, you can say that right now that the government does own Fannie and Freddie, But it is true that before the crash, during the lead up and through the mortgage boom years, Fannie and Freddie were both privately owned. They had, CEOs and executives who were getting bonus based on profits. They had shareholders and operated pretty much like a normal corporation.
Right.
Although there was always that sense that if they got in trouble,
We'd bail them out.
Just as the government has bailed out many other big financial institutions in the aftermath of the financial
crash.
Because
they were federally chartered corporations, we would bail them out. I mean, there was it wasn't just implicit; it was nearly explicit anyway.
Yeah, and it was more explicit with Fannie and Freddie than it was with other financial institutions. Although the truth was, I think most financial institutions assume that the government would backstop them if they
got into much trouble. And we did, and we shouldn't have.
But
that's a whole other thing. But with Fannie and Freddie, these used to be federal agencies. They're now they then became totally privatized over the years and started behaving badly, as private organizations tend to do. I can't believe people want to do this to Social Security, for example. And then the government took them over in essentially receivership. In essentially bankruptcy or whatever, after they crashed, but they're still technically private institutions, are they not? That we're just kind of running in receivership.
Yes, yeah, sort of like General Motors was still a private institution,
right,
was
for a while. And the goal is to reprivatize
them, government controlled for a brief time.
So when they were making these bets, was that I'm assuming that was before we had taken them over, when they were simply operating as for profits and, hey, making bets on people going down in flames was profitable.
No, that actually is not true, because it seems that the bets that they were making were or they certainly started increasing these bets dramatically in late 2010, which was long after the government had put them into receivership. So this is another example of the government not really watching the store
right.
very well.
Right. Well, it's and the problem is that the store is neither fish nor fowl.
Right.
Or at least a problem. I mean, in your analysis, Michael Hudson, what is the problem, and what should be done about it?
Well, the problem with Fannie and Freddie, I think most critics are going to say, most folks who are concerned about average homeowners, is that they've kind of lost sense of their mission, that because of the years of privatization that they went through, and because of all the financial incentives for executives, they really sort of transformed from sort of quasi-public, quasi-governmental non-profit-like institutions to
right.
for-profit institutions, and that's still in their DNA. Even if they're government-owned now, that's still in their DNA. And
so they stopped working for the public good and started working for profit.
Right, and there's just a lot of critics, a lot of folks who say basically Fannie and Freddie have put their own finances ahead of the welfare of American homeowners.
Why not just completely nationalize them?
Well, that's an argument that's been going back and forth, but right now, because of the Republican majorities in Washington, it's kind of hard to do. It's hard to pull off.
Isn't there a need, though, for agencies like these to backstop, whether it's FHA loans or veterans loans or, frankly, just bank loans to provide that they're kind of like a mortgage guarantee company.
And there's an argument that there's a role there if you go back to the sort of the old style, what they did. I mean, they were never perfect institutions, but, kind of throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they did provide, pretty basic protections for homeowners, pretty basic impetus to increase homeownership in a conservative, responsible way, what happened in the past decade, where the idea of that home ownership was everything, and we're going to throw loans out there, and we're going to incentivize people to put people into homes that ultimately they're not going to be able to afford.
Right. So, if not Fannie and Freddie, then who?
Well, that's a good question. And the debate is really going on, but sadly the debate is not really based on facts. It's a lot of it is sort of demonizing Fannie and Freddie, there's plenty to criticize with Fannie and Freddie, what they did before the meltdown, during the meltdown, and since the meltdown. But part of the problem is you have some ideologues who are arguing that Fannie and Freddie are basically patient zero. They are the culprits that caused the financial meltdown, and,
right.
and Barney Frank defended them at one point or said some nice things about them, and therefore he should go to jail. So, of course, the evidence
is... And Newt Gingrich consulted for them.
Right, right. The evidence is that really Fannie and Freddie loans, that Fannie backed too many risky loans, but Fannie and Freddie backed loans were much less likely to go bad than loans backed by Wall Street banks. As a matter of fact, Wall Street bankrolled loans were 4.5 times more likely to go into serious default than Fannie and Freddie loans.
Right.
So, but unfortunately, those kind of facts aren't part of the argument.
No, this has become an ideological argument about whether government
right.
can do things and versus the free market. Michael Hudson, iWatchNews.org, Center for Public Integrity. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate the overview, the insight, and the wisdom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mass arrests, chemical weapons, nationwide solidarity, 400 members, 400 patriots of the Occupy movement busted over the weekend. What's coming up? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Glad to have you with us, Robin, in Bluemont, Virginia. Hey, Robin, you're active in the Occupy DC movement? Robin? Hello? Okay. No, Robin. Larry in Williamsburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Well, do you think what's going on in the country, in the world right now, is part of what George Bush said in one of his speeches? It's called the New World Order?
Yeah. I think George Herbert Walker Bush, that was the George Bush Sr. said that, and I don't know if it was a State of the Union address or if it was just a speech. It's my recollection is it was one of his State of the Union addresses, but I may be wrong. But in any case, he referred to a new world order, and the new world order is let's, and this is something that conservatives have been pushing for since the 50s, and well, arguably since the 30s. They started pushing back on Franklin Roosevelt, calling him a communist and a socialist. And that new world order that they want is basically a world that is run, that is stable, that is predictable, that is safe for the very, very rich, and doesn't have much of a middle class, and doesn't have much democracy. It just has the patina of it, just has the appearance of it. And so, yes, in answer to your question, Larry, I think that that's absolutely what he was talking about. And I think that we're at least a third of the way, maybe two-thirds of the way there, and I think that a lot of us are pushing back, and there's a good chance we'll stop it. John in Long Beach, Mississippi. Hey, John, what's up?
Hello, how are you? Very good day today. It's nice and warm out.
Yeah, it is here, too.
My question is simple. The Bank of America and Wells Fargo both, they're telling people that they paid every single penny back that they owe the government. And
right.
I'd like to know, basically, can you give me a spin on that?
Well, it's true. The question is not did they pay back the money. I mean, you know, there's a lot of businesses that you know are on the brink that if you were to just give them not just the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that the Treasury Department gave them, but the trillions of dollars that the Fed gave them at zero interest loans. And if you basically give them the ability to make money at no risk. What these banks did is they borrowed trillions of dollars, with a T, trillions of dollars from the Fed at no interest rate. And then they used that money to buy federal bonds. In other words, they loaned that money to the Treasury. And the Treasury is paying 1, 2, 3% interest, depending on the bonds, depending on what you buy bond funds or buy bonds. And so if you get $1 trillion and for 6 months you make 3% interest on it, that's, $3 billion, and then you return the money and you say, hey, thank you very much for that money, and now I've got $3 billion more, and rinse, wash, and repeat, right? And this is the game that the banksters played over the last couple of years to get themselves quote out of debt and pay off the government, and they did pay back the bailout, but that doesn't mean that what they did was right, and that doesn't mean that our government allowing now six banks to control 65 assets equal to 65% of the entire GDP of the United States is a good thing. I think it's a terrible thing, and I don't think we ever should have allowed it. John, thanks a lot for the call and for bringing it up. Ron in Las Lunas, New Mexico. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I kind of ticked off this morning. I'm a little hot under the collar. I saw on Democracy Now! That the Occupy Oakland people had attempted to burn a flag.
Well, let me qualify that. The Occupy Oakland people didn't do that. A small group of people who the news media say are associated with, and may be, but they're not officially representatives of, the Occupy Oakland movement tried to burn a flag, yeah, in the city hall.
That's fine. I just had another suggestion about what we can do with flags. If they wanted to go into that city hall and take that flag, they should have took it and they should have kept it because it's not their flag anymore anyway. It's ours.
Yeah, rather than burn it. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And they should be doing that all over the country, liberating flags.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. Ron, thank you very much. I can't advocate that. It's, I'm not going to advocate committing criminal acts like theft on the air. I do, however, believe, maybe I shouldn't have a however in there, I do believe that the movement should be using flags a lot more. And, brand yourself with the flag and then let the right-wingers try and go after you. Good luck on them. JP in Detroit, listening to us on XM. Hey, JP, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I enjoy listening to you because I'm interested in what the left has to say, and you're one of the prominent voices. I'm a Tea Party member. I'm a neocon. And you guys constantly misrepresent what we stand for. We stand for education, for health care, for, charity to people that need it. We stand for retirement benefits for everybody, but we don't believe that government is a mechanism to accomplish these ends. In fact, we believe that government serves itself. Case in point, within the Obama administration, the banks have made more money in 2 years than under 8 years under George Bush. They're both corrupt. George Bush's administration, Barack Obama's administration, they are a market for corruption. So anybody that can't get what they
JP,
want...
JP, I understand that you believe in the fantasy that if you turn all of our schools over to the big corporations, that they will somehow make sure that we all get a wonderful education. And that if we continue to allow people like Stephen Hemsley and Dollar Bill McGuire to make $1 billion off, skimming money off the top of our healthcare dollars, somehow we're going to get better healthcare. I got it that you believe that. I disagree with you.
How does a corporation make money by screwing the consumer? The government's got a monopoly on education right now. So as a result, our education outcomes are flatlined, and the cost per pupil is going up. In fact, we spend more per pupil than any other country in the world except Norway.
The government does not have a monopoly on education, and I would assert to you that the extent to which the government doesn't have a monopoly anymore, we've seen ever since the 80s, increasingly, you've seen this charter school movement grow, you've seen private schools grow, and what's happening is they're siphoning off the high-end kids, the wealthy kids, the good achieving kids, and they're leaving the poor performing students to the public schools, and then they try to convince decent people like you that those schools
the government spends hundreds of billions of dollars on education throughout the country.
JP, that most of that money is for kids with learning
You're
disabilities.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is the problem of people who are operating with half the information. If federal aid to education is mostly for kids with severe learning disabilities. We'll be back. Occupying the media, Tom Hartman here with you. California, by the way, came a few votes shy yesterday, apparently over the weekend, maybe it was Friday, just a couple of, two votes shy of passing a single-payer for everybody in the state bill, which would radically reduce health care costs and radically improve quality of health care in the state by getting the profit motive, the for-profit corporations, out of the way. So you got no more skimming 20, 30, 40% of the money off the top so it can be given to stockholders and CEOs, which these for-profit health insurance companies are basically required to do. You know, and instead, you know, just let it be administered by the state. It was interesting over the weekend. There was a right winger on one of the TV shows, and he was going on and on about how, I remember back in the 60s, we didn't, you know, the health insurance companies weren't jacking up prices like crazy and all, you know, and I don't understand what's different. I'll tell you what's different. Back in the 60s, every single state in the United States required that if you were going to provide health insurance in that state, you had to be a nonprofit corporation. This is why Blue Cross Blue Shield all across the country were nonprofit corporations. It's why Kaiser Permanente was a nonprofit corporation. It's why all of the health insurance companies started out as nonprofits. And then during the Reagan administration, it was like, hey, what's wrong with profit? And one by one, states started repealing those laws. And one by one, you saw major health insurance companies come into being or nonprofits flip into for-profits. And suddenly, health insurance costs are going up 15-20% a year, whereas they used to go up less than inflation. Now they go up more than inflation. Yeah, are you surprised? And you've got, like, you know, like United Healthcare has over 100 executives making over $1 million a year. Back when they were a nonprofit, I guarantee you they weren't. And our healthcare back then was among the best in the world, and now we're like 28th or something like that. So anyhow, California became very close to that. In the next hour, we're going to have one of the sponsors of that state, that piece of state legislation. But four, quote, moderate, end quote, Democrats did not vote on this thing. There's going to be another vote tomorrow, Tuesday, in California. So those of us, those of you who are listening to me in California, and we're on a whole bunch of radio stations in California, I mean, we're on a whole bunch of radio stations all over the country, but I know we have a lot of listeners in California, all up and down the coast. Contact these four members of your state Senate, Alex Padilla, Juan Vargas, Michael Rubio, and Rod Wright, particularly if they represent you. But even if they don't, and say to these Democrats, please show up and vote for health care for all, single-payer health care for all on Tuesday, because the vote is going to happen. And it'll save the state a lot of money. And California could be Saskatchewan. You know, back in the 50s, I believe it was the 50s, it might have been the 60s, Saskatchewan passed a single-payer health care system for their one province. And pretty soon Alberta and Manitoba and Ottawa, the rest of them are looking at this and going, whoa. So as I pointed out when I started this rant, at 2:20 we're going to have State Representative Leno on, who is one of the sponsors of this legislation. We'll get back to it. But that was important enough, I wanted to repeat it. Or give you the setup. Twitter is going to be censoring tweets in countries where they're illegal. No more Arab Springs. A lot of people are very upset with this. Multimillionaire lobbyist Grover Norquist is now calling for the impeachment of President Obama if he allows the Bush tax cuts to expire at the end of this year, 11 months from now. The impeachment. It's incredible. And while our nation's infrastructure is crumbling, we have a $2 trillion physical infrastructure deficit. I'd say we have a $1 trillion intellectual infrastructure deficit, because that's how much student loan debt there is out there. That's $3 trillion. While our nation's infrastructure is crumbling, John Boehner announced that the Republicans are going to hold money to rebuild bridges and roads hostage until the president approves the Keystone XL pipeline promoted by the big oil companies who fund John Boehner and the other Republicans. Does this make sense to you? It's amazing. Archie in Yucca Valley, California. Hey, Archie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Man, I'm as ranted up as you are. But I'm a little under the weather, but I had to call. Do me a favor. When you showed that clip about Ronald Reagan talking about fairness in taxes, play it again. Just keep reminding us. And have you used the word B-A-N-E, Bane, in your vocabulary section? Also, I found a quote for you from Confucius, and it just, oh, it's beautiful. Here you go. In a country well-governed
poverty is something to be ashamed of. In a country badly governed, wealth is something to be ashamed of. And also, one other thing, let me tell all the youngsters out there, in the 60s, it took a long time. Be patient and take all your old cell phones. Just remember, there's still cameras, kids.
Yeah, there you go.
And if they're going to confiscate them, that's all right. But if you can document, you know, these policemen have to understand we're standing for them, too.
Yep, yep. No, Archie, very well said. You're on your fourth topic now, and there's a lot of other people who want to jump in. So
yes,
thank
sir.
You for the call. I appreciate it. But excellent points, excellent points. Elizabeth in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Hey, Elizabeth, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Love your program on Free Speech TV.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. I was actually calling from the last segment. You had posed the question about the boom and bust of the cycles of our economy and whether there's a better way. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to remind you of Richard Wolff and his idea of cooperatives.
Yes.
And I think that we could get our country to that point if we would start by ending the philosophical debates about whether Wall Street robbed us blind and get the indictments on the table. And we could start with that first story you told the news segment about Fannie and Freddie and the fact that they were betting on people foreclosing rather than helping them by refinancing.
Right, and this is what this is all the result of Lyndon Johnson privatizing them back in '68 to help pay for the war in Vietnam. And this is what happens.
Sure,
everybody says, you know, like in what the Germans are saying to the Greeks now: sell off your government properties. Well, we sold off a government property, it got privatized, and it turned around and bit us in the butt. Elizabeth,
here's what happened.
That's right.
Well, that's exactly right. And I just say we have to follow up these. The average man on the street knows that we were robbed. Our tax money was robbed by Wall Street. We need to get it back, and we have to file the indictments and get it done.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Thank you, Elizabeth. Randy in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Good day, Tom. I wanted to mention, a few callers ago was talking about how small government was preferred by the Tea Party.
Right.
And big government did not exist until the philosophy of small government came to Washington. And it is an unholy alliance between government and lobbyists and corporations that created large government, big government. And if Grover Norquist, an individual, a citizen, a lobbyist, is calling for the impeachment of the President of the United States based on flimsy
It's based on the fact that he's going to allow the Bush tax cut to expire and thus start paying down the deficit. You know?
Grover Norquist is big government.
Yeah,
and
no, I'm with you. What Americans have to get, and thank you, Randy, for the call, what Americans have to get is that we don't have big government in the United States. Government represents about 23% of our GDP. In most European countries, it's over 50%. In Canada, it's about 50%. In Australia, it's a little under 50%. But they're all in that neighborhood. Why? Why are they twice as big as us? Because in those countries, government provides good, high-quality, free public education all the way up to the level of a PhD or an MD, and they provide good, high-quality, free medical care. And as a result of that, people actually are socially mobile. You can become what you can become. You can be anything you're capable of. And if you fall through the cracks in society, there's somebody who's going to catch you on the way down. Karen in Mealytown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Karen, what's up? Mealytown.
You mentioned earlier about bigger use of flags during the Occupy movement.
It's just my suggestion.
I think that each camp should either have their own American flag or take one from the location they're occupying and instead of burning it, rehang it upside down. I think that's an international sign that the country's in distress.
Yeah.
And I think that would be not only an illustration of nonviolent protest, but an excellent statement for the state of our country.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, there's when you hang a flag upside down, it is a sign of distress, and under certain circumstances, police agencies are obliged to respond to it. I don't know the legalities of that, Karen. That's why the Tea Party, I think, said, oh, let's just go with a different flag. And they took the Don't Tread on Me flag, you know, one of the early flags of the revolutionaries, which might be another option. Karen, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of your calls, and we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service here in Washington, D.C., find out everything that's going on around the world. Occupying the airwaves, it's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service here in D.C. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Well, there's plenty up today, I can assure you. And one thing that is definitely up is Occupy D.C. I don't know whether you've already been talking
about it. We've had three guests on from Occupy D.C. Of course, we're on two different radio stations live here in Washington, D.C., 1480 a.m. and 1390 a.m., and we're getting a lot of feedback.
And I will just say that the noon deadline has passed, and they are still there, and I will move on.
Well, what the Supreme Court ruled in the Clark versus Committee for Creative Nonviolence case in 1984 was that you can occupy federal property 24/7 as a political statement of free speech. You just can't sleep on it.
Right.
And I personally disagree with that. I think sleeping is, if it's done for political purposes, is a statement as well. But nonetheless, my guess is that the park police are going to show up tonight after it's dark and when it's time to go to bed, or maybe at 3 or 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning, as they've done in Oakland, you know, when there's not as many people watching, there's not as many cameras around, and that's probably when you're going to see some action here.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think it's over.
So what else is up?
Senate Republicans are flexing their constitutional muscles. Today they introduced a bill that would have Congress approve the Keystone XL pipeline rather than waiting for President Obama to grant a permit. It was sponsored by 43 Republicans and also Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia. And what it would do is it would greenlight the pipeline outside of Nebraska. And then inside Nebraska, Nebraskan officials would basically have as long as they want to find an alternative route.
Through the state or around the state? Because around the state, they're going to have to negotiate with other states.
Inside Nebraska. So outside of Nebraska, it's green lighted, but when in the bit inside Nebraska, which is the tricky part, they would have as long as they need to find an alternative route around the Sandhills.
And this is because Nebraska is the one state that has officially said to the federal government, no thank you?
Right. They've said that we've got to find a way of getting around this environmentally sensitive Sandhills region.
Right. Okay.
So the Congressional Research Service this month did rule that Senator John Hervin, Republican of North Dakota's bill, is actually doable. They said that Congress has the authority under the Constitution's Commerce Clause to oversee commerce with foreign powers.
Sure, but what I don't understand, and I don't dispute that, what I don't understand is why, other than political bribery, why anybody would want to bring incredibly dirty oil all the way from Canada down to the Gulf Coast to refine and then throw all of the dirt from that dirty oil up into the air and make Cancer Alley even more cancerous, and then export the finished product, the gasoline, the diesel fuel, and the jet fuel. I mean, gasoline is now the number one manufactured product that the United States exports. We export more gasoline than we export cars or washing machines or anything. And this is just to make more money for, you know, the big oil companies. Why would anybody be in support of this? It doesn't make any sense to me. And it's a 1,000-mile-long terrorist target.
That is a question that I cannot answer other than to say that while quoting vastly different numbers, and the number that TransCanada itself quotes, they say that it will provide an enormous amount of jobs.
Yeah, 20-some-odd thousand. And now Greenpeace is suing them, saying that that number is exaggerated by at least an order of sevenfold.
Right.
And so, again, the question, why would we create tens of thousands of more cancer deaths in the United States Why would we put environmentally sensitive areas and aquifers at risk? Why would we create a 1,000-mile-long terrorist target right through the heart of our country, all so that the oil companies can export more gasoline and make more profit? I don't understand it, other than that a number of members of Congress have their campaigns largely paid for by the big oil industries.
Ooh, you think that might be a possibility, Tom?
Yeah, oh, geez. Okay, let's move along.
Today, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, she says, getting away from the dripping with sarcasm,
yes.
announced that he will introduce this week the Pay a Fair Share Act. This will ensure that millionaires paying lower tax rates than middle-class taxpayers will henceforth pay a 30% tax rate. So if you make more than $1 million a year, you'd be required to calculate your overall tax rate, taking into account all your income and the full sum of what you pay in taxes. If that amount adds up to less than 30%, you'd be required to make up the difference.
So it's basically an alternative minimum tax for people who earn over $1 million a year.
Correct. Correct. So he will introduce this week. He says he's attracted two co-sponsors for the bill. He did not name them on the call, and that more will be rolled out in coming days.
That's great.
Also today in the briefing with Jay Carney on the Buffett rule, Jay Carney said, don't expect any more details on that before the budget, which of course is coming out on the 13th of February. But it is a principal guide to tax reform. And it's not fair to ask millionaires to have a lower tax rate than ordinary Americans who are earning much less than that.
Right.
Moving on to the campaign trail, just very briefly, an internal Gingrich campaign memo obtained by the Daily Caller shows the campaign is planning to continue after Tuesday's Florida primary, stating simply, this race is just getting started. It also goes into detail of Romney's lack of conservative grassroots support, stresses Romney only has 33 of the 1,144 needed delegates, and goes into some detail about how the delegates could be proportioned, and says essentially guarantees that no candidate will secure the nomination anytime soon, and the map quickly becomes more favorable for Gingrich due to proportional nature. Talks about some of those southern states.
Yeah, and well, the southern states sounds great for Gingrich, except that Florida is right next door to Georgia, and he's not carrying Florida.
Exactly. But they seem to think he will get those 76 delegates in Georgia, and that's a gamble.
Wouldn't surprise me if he took Georgia, but, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, the other states around there, we'll see. I guess we'll see. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's new book, Self-Empowerment. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, is it an amazing... You know, there's a story in today's Financial Times that, in fact, it's the lead story, the front story, the top story. Top story at the top of the Financial Times. The headline, Greek Fury at Plan for EU Control of Budget. Now, this, you know, on its surface sounds like some kind of, kind of weird, wonky thing. But let me just lay this out for you. Really simply. And tell you why it's important to us. And in fact, I'll tell you in advance why it's important to us, because it's happening right now in the state of Michigan. And there are other states where you have Republican governors who want to do the same. In fact, it's one of the articles of faith among the libertarians and the Tea Partiers. So let me lay out what's going on. The Greeks are in debt. They are in debt in large part, as Matt Taibbi laid out in a brilliant piece in the Rolling Stone some time back, because, I'm sorry, we're too far into this to change topics. I'm not going to. They are in debt because some time back, as Matt Taibbi laid out in Rolling Stone magazine, the you know, Goldman Sachs went in and sold the Greeks, you know, in order to get into the EU, Greece had to get their debt below 3% of GDP, and they couldn't. And so Goldman Sachs helped them work this sophisticated financial scam, basically, that allowed it to look like their debt was below that point, but in fact actually made their debt even worse. And then and this was back in 2000, like something three or something like that. And so then when in 2008, Goldman Sachs was going down and the Greek debt was all invested in derivatives, suddenly Greece is wildly in debt. In large part because of the big banksters in the United States. So now comes along Germany. Saying to Greece, why don't you just let us take over management of your economy? I'm not making this up. You've got one sovereign nation, Germany, saying that the entire European Union should put Greece into receivership and let the technocrats at the EU out of Brussels run Greece and sell off private property, sell off public property, sell off the Acropolis, sell off the historic Greek buildings and things, sell off these things and just say, it was nice, but let's let Goldman Sachs own it now. Or let's let the Exxon Mobil Acropolis brought to you by Exxon, and to charge admission for that matter. Turn it into Disneyland. As you can imagine, the Greeks are really upset by this. In fact, let me just share with you the first paragraph of this lead article, top of today's Financial Times. Greece's finance minister has angrily rejected a German plan for the Eurozone to impose a budget overseer onto Athens in return for a new $130 billion bailout, saying it would improperly force his country to choose between, quote, financial assistance and national dignity, end quote. You got that? So Greece is saying, hey guys, take a leap. In Michigan, meanwhile, Governor Rick Snyder, the Republican, got a law passed through the Republican legislature, the Republican House, and the Republican Senate in the state of Michigan, saying that he would have the power to do what Germany wants to do to Greece, only he could do it to communities within Michigan. Now, he's the governor of the whole state, but he's not the mayor of Benton Harbor. And so what he's saying is, what Rick Scott is saying is, Benton Harbor's not doing so well. Hey, it's a poor community to begin with, relatively speaking. It got hit by a recession. It's largely African-American, where you've got unemployment rates that are way higher than they are for white Americans. You get 30, 40, 50% unemployment in that community. And so we're going to take one of my buddies. Rick Snyder says he's going to take one of his buddies, pay the guy a couple $100,000 a year, send him into Benton Harbor, throw the elected representatives out. To hell with what the people want. The people voted for those guys. So what? Tough on that. And as you know, we've had, one of the members of city Council of the city of Benton Harbor on this program, at least a half a dozen times over the last year that Rick Snyder's been doing this. And it's not just Benton Harbor. He's looking at Detroit next. He's already done it to a school district in a Detroit suburb. In fact, one that was performing quite well, thank you very much. But his buddies in the private education industry, oh boy, we could make some money with this. And there's this park in Benton Harbor along the Lake Michigan shorefront that is arguably the most valuable property. And, there's a river that runs right out to Lake Michigan there, and on the other side of the river is St. Joe, which is a largely white and more affluent community. On the south side is Benton Harbor, which is a largely African-American and not affluent community. But this park is in Benton Harbor, and it was given to the city in 1907. On the caveat that it stay that way forever, a park. It was given to the city by a white family at the time that Benton Harbor was largely white. Now it's largely African American. But still, it was given forever. And it's like the jewel, the crown jewel of Benton Harbor. And so Rick Snyder's manager comes in and says, hey, look at this park. That's worth some serious bucks. And under this new legislation from the state, he can just sell it. So let's find a corporation that wants to build condos for rich people right on the shore of Lake Michigan. I mean, this is probably the most valuable, you know, and this is going on in Michigan right now as we speak. To hell with elected officials, to hell with democracy. We're going to run your city for you. We're going to throw out the people who were voted in. And we're going to tell the voters that they have no say in how this is done. Now, when Germany tries to do that to Greece, Greece says, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And Greece is, you know, they're trying to figure out what to do. I mean, the problem is that they're stuck with the euro. I've been saying all along that Greece should have pulled out of the EU, should have said, screw it, we're going to go back to the drachma. If we can't make this thing work, we will simply inflate the drachma. The bondholders will take a haircut, but we'll pay it off. You know, the United States will never face this problem. The right-wingers are constantly going, oh, look at what's going on in Greece. You don't want that to happen in America, do you? Look at our giant debt that was run up by Reagan, Bush, and Bush. It's a disaster. No, it's not a disaster. People are buying our debt right now, and they're paying, you know, like, and we're paying like 1% in interest. Everybody wants to own U.S. debt. Why? Because we own our own currency. If Greece owned their own currency, they'd be in great shape. If Benton Harbor owned their own currency, they'd be in good shape. But you can't do that in the United States. Every state, every city is part of this union, as Lincoln called it. So anyhow, I just find it incredibly ironic that the Greeks are saying, you know, we kind of like democracy. We like making our own decisions, even though the Germans want to impose a decision on them. And at the same time, in Michigan, Benton Harbor and Detroit and other communities are saying to Rick Snyder and the Republicans who you know, own the control, the governorship, the House and the Senate, they're saying, you know, we really like democracy. We like our communities. Please stop stealing them. But in Michigan, they don't have the power to do it. At least Greece has the power to tell Germany to take a hike. Benton Harbor doesn't have that power. We're less democratic than the European Union countries? How did that happen?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And by the way, it's not just Michigan. As I said, the Koch brothers, Alec, you know, all these groups, they want every state to have this kind of power.
I wish they all could be.
Slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Our tribute, Jacob's tribute to California here. State Senator Mark Leno is on the line with us. He represents the 3rd District of the state of California to the state Senate in California and is the sponsor of Senate Bill 810, the California Universal Health Care Act. Senator, welcome to the program.
Tom, my pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us about SB 810.
Certainly. As you mentioned, our bill is a single-payer universal health care reform bill, which will provide health care coverage for and provision for every resident in California. Think of it as Medicare for all. So rather than having to reach the threshold of 65 years of age, everyone in California would have quality health care, focusing on primary and preventive care, so we would keep everyone healthier and attend to medical needs as they happen up front rather than letting people get ever more ill, denying them access to the care they need when they need it, and then, of course, having to deal with it at the most expensive point of delivery, which is the county emergency room.
Right, which is the system we have right now. So how much money would this first of all, I'm assuming that rich people will still be able to buy health insurance and get, you know, 5-star rooms and catered gourmet food and things like that if they want.
Well, the law, once enacted, would provide a very high standard of care and very comprehensive care at that. But one could only purchase private health insurance for anything that goes above and beyond what the single payer system.
Okay, so that would be for supplementary things.
It would be illegal
plastic surgery
insurance in the state of California.
Right. Okay. Got it. So in that regard, it would function like it does in most fully developed democracies.
That's right.
Yeah. So how much will this save the state of California?
Well,
or the citizens of the state of California.
Put out by the Lewin Report a few years back, so it's a little bit dated, but it indicated that there would be close to $10 billion in savings in the first year alone. And how we pay for this is not unlike for Social Security. There would be a deduction at the workplace, so the employee would have a small part of it, the employer would have a small part of it, and when I say small, less than what everyone is paying now, because there would be no additional copays and deductibles and out of pocket. It would be
right.
Just that one deductible through the paycheck. And we would put all of the federal money that we are currently getting for all of the health care provided in California into this one health care trust fund. We would also put all the state funds into that, along with the employer-employee contributions. And when you take out the for-profit middleman, the for-profit middleman that provides no health care whatsoever, does no health research, provides no hospital beds, and makes its many billions of dollars in profit each year by a business model which succeeds when it denies us health care, there are huge savings. Also, with the bulk purchasing of pharmaceuticals and durable medical equipment like eyeglasses and hearing aids and wheelchairs, and then also investing in preventive care through primary care physicians, there's enough to cover everybody and to finally contain costs. That's the one thing our current system is horribly failing at. You know, we were spending, as a percentage of gross domestic product, as recently as 1960, 5% of GDP on healthcare costs. We hit 11% in year 2000. We are currently at 17.6% of GDP spent on healthcare costs, with projections that will hit 25% of every dollar produced in this country on healthcare costs by 2025,
right,
and will pass 50% by 2050.
Which is greater than total federal spending. It's amazing.
Care costs.
Yeah, yeah. So now I understand you had a vote on this last week, and that you were two votes shy of the necessary 20, even though you got a majority of the votes in the state Senate, you were two votes shy of what you needed to pass this bill, and that four Democrats, state senators, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Alex Padilla, Juan Vargas, Michael Rubio, and Rod Wright abstained from voting on this legislation. Are you going to hold another vote and ask these four guys to come along and vote yes?
That certainly is the intent. Now, this is not new in California. We are very proud of the fact that our legislature, on a purely party line vote, put a single payer universal health care reform bill on our governor's desk, first in 2007. It was vetoed by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and then a second time in 2009. And that was authored by my former colleague, Senator Sheila Kuehl from Santa Monica, who's now turned out.
And also vetoed by Schwarzenegger, right?
Yes, I picked it up a couple years ago at the request of the single-payer advocates throughout the state, and we got it off the Senate floor, though it stalled in the second house in the Assembly. So we reintroduced the bill again last year, and we got it through the policy committee, the fiscal committee. Last week on the floor, it fell two votes short, with a small handful of Democrats who had previously voted for it not voting for it this time. So the terminology is called reconsideration. We can take it up one more time before a deadline of tomorrow to get it out of the first house.
Right. So if any of our listeners in California are represented by Alex Padilla, Juan Vargas, Michael Rubio, or Rod Wright, or are simply willing to call them and say, please support Senate Bill 810. Is that the kind of help you need?
That certainly is helpful. You know, it's interesting, in these conversations, we almost give all of the Republicans a free ride. We don't even criticize them but we just write them off.
Well, they're all voting against it, right?
They all vote against it.
Yeah, of course. But they don't control the House or the Assembly, and they don't control the Senate. And Jerry Brown will sign this, unlike Arnold Schwarzenegger, who vetoed it twice. And California could be the Saskatchewan of the United States, the first state with single-payer health care that then, you know, everybody else looks at and says, wow, that works really great. Why don't we do that here?
accurate. That's how Canada got to it nationwide. It started in one province and spread to others.
That's right.
And that's how it happened here as well. Now, I just want to be careful. I can't assure you that I've been told by Jerry Brown that he would sign it, but we do know he thoroughly understands the topic, because when he ran for president of the United States against Bill Clinton in a primary in 1992, single-payer universal health care reform was one of his platforms.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
State Senator Mark Leno, thanks a lot for being with us, Senator.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you. And we'll have a link to your website on our homepage at tomhartman.com. The good, the bad, and the very, very oxycanthously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. The good, President Obama. President Obama's reelection campaign is refunding the campaign donations of five registered federal lobbyists who made contributions to the campaign between April and September of last year. Research conducted by the Center for Responsive Politics showed that the Obama campaign accepted $2,250 from the five lobbyists, as well as $4,500 from three individuals who became federal lobbyists after donating to the campaign. The Obama campaign has pledged to refuse contributions to lobbyists ever since the 2008 campaign. This policy by the Obama campaign is meant to curb the influences of high-powered lobbyists who see money as a means of control over the campaign. It's refreshing to see a political figure trying to weed out the influences of lobbyists in politics, however. The same can't be said for the likes of Mitt Romney, who has already accepted over $250,000 from registered federal lobbyists. The bad. RNC Chairman Rince Priebus. Priebus compared President Obama to Captain Schettino, I believe that's how it's said, the captain of the run-aground Italian cruise ship who abandoned the ship before all the passengers had safely gotten off. In an interview on Face the Nation Sunday morning, Priebus said this in response to a question on the GOP primary season.
In a few months, this is all going to be ancient history, and we're going to talk about our own little Captain Schettino, which is President Obama, who's abandoning the ship here in the United States and is more interested in campaigning than doing his job as president.
Right. Nearly 17 people died in the cruise ship accident as a result of gross conduct by the captain. Mr. Priebus is a little confused. Apparently, President Obama is consistently presenting legislation to Congress and trying to do his job as president, only to have it shot down and held hostage by the Republican Party. Priebus and the Republicans are the only ones abandoning ship on the American people. And the very, very ugly North Carolina Republican State Representative Larry Pittman. Pittman has some radical ideas on how to better enforce the death penalty and who should face it, and in an email to the North Carolina General Assembly said, "We need to make the death penalty a real deterrent again by actually carrying it out. Every appeal that can be made should have to be made at one time, not in a serial manner." He went on to say, "If murderers, and I would include abortionists, rapists, and kidnappers as well, are actually executed, it will at least have the deterrent effect upon them. For my money, we should go back to public hangings." End of quote. The outcry for abortionists to face the death penalty is nothing new, with legislation being introduced in multiple states over the past few years that would essentially legalize the murder of abortion providers by protecting those who kill them. Not to mention Bill O'Reilly's obsession with Dr. George Tiller, who he referred to as the baby killer, Tiller the baby killer, culminated with a madman eventually shooting Tiller dead in church. State Representative Larry Pittman should watch his words, or tragically, he too may have blood on his hands one day, and that's very, very ugly. So much going on. Multimillionaire Grover Norquist calling for the, and lobbyist, multimillionaire lobbyist Grover Norquist, who has every Republican in the House and Senate in the palm of his hand because they all signed an oath of loyalty to him rather than to the Constitution, is now calling for the impeachment of President Obama if Obama doesn't extend the Bush tax cut for the rich at the end of the year when it expires. Brilliant, right? I mean, this is like, I guess it's a good PR tool. And Freddie Mac was making money betting on household foreclosures when they were supposed to be stopping for household foreclosures. Go figure. Victor in Chicago. Hey, Victor, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering on what you thought about the generational shift that's occurring right now with the Occupy movement, and where do you see it going from here? I noticed a stat saying that Generation Y outnumbers the baby boomers now, and I was wondering how that can affect and control the Occupy movement in a way.
I think it's a marvelous thing. I think it's an absolute marvelous thing. And the generation in between your generation and my generation, you know, the generation that's now in their 40s and 50s, they're busy raising families, and maybe the mid-30s, busy raising families, and they're not Gen X. Yeah, they're not so politically involved, it seems, generally speaking. And it's just wonderful to see young people coming in with a lot of political involvement. It seems like it's like every other generation that gets political, you know. And I, you know, I'm just so excited to see all these young people in these Occupy movements. Reminds me of my own, you know, young years in SDS. And you know, good on you. Right. So, makes sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Scott in Skowhegan, Maine. Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
How do you say your city?
Yeah, Skowhegan.
Skowhegan, okay, what's up?
I love your show, dude. You're something else. I love it.
Thanks.
I watch it every day.
Thanks.
Hey, I got a question for you. You know, with all the freedoms and liberties that have been taken in the last year alone, and the more increasingly the police become violent towards, you know, the Occupy Wall Street people, mm-hmm. trying to exercise their rights, of which they have a right to do, regardless of where it's at, I believe. Can you honestly, well, I don't know how you would phrase it, but I want to ask it. Can you honestly say that this won't become a more violent or as violent as the police are being as far as a movement? I mean, look what we did over a bunch of tea. You know?
Yeah, no, I know.
But it's come to the point where, I mean, they're literally, I mean, they're threatening to, you know, to get the president out of the office if he doesn't go along with the corporations.
Yeah.
Just stupid
well,
stuff
first
like
of all,
that.
What we did about
people going to take
what we did with the T is
take your answer off the air.
Okay, Scott, thanks a lot for the call. What we did with the T was we fought against a foreign government that was occupying what the people of that generation at that time believed was their country, and you know, I mean, we could get into a debate about the Native American role in that, but still, they thought it was their country. So that was a foreign occupation. The Civil War, you had states trying to secede because they felt that again, there's debates about why, but by and large, there was a sense that these were, that they were not, that Southern states were not being represented in New York and Washington. And I don't, you know, I don't think that those are, I just don't think that we're in analogous times. I think that we're at an analogous time in terms of the need for revolution. But I think it's a revolution like Franklin Roosevelt led in the 1930s, a political revolution, a revolution that arguably Ronald Reagan led in the 1980s, a political revolution. Now, Reagan's went in a direction that I think ultimately damaged and destroyed the middle class and damaged the country. But it was, nonetheless, a political revolution. And it's time for another one. Now, whether the small fraction of people within the Occupy movement, or even on the fringes of the Occupy movement, or who may claim the banner of the Occupy movement without the support of the Occupy movement, whether they who are engaging in vandalism, you know, broke into the Oakland City Hall or walked into the Oakland City Hall and burned a flag, that kind of thing, whether they will become progressively more and more violent as the police become progressively more and more violent, I don't honestly know, but I believe the answer is no. Because what they're going to find is that violence doesn't work. The nonviolence is 1,000 times more powerful. When those young people at the University of California at Davis sat down and that officer walked up and down that row with that giant oversized can of industrial-sized military-grade pepper spray and whacked them in the eyes, they converted 1,000 times more people to their cause than the people who burned the flag in the Oakland City Hall night before last. In fact, I would say they probably pushed people away from their cause. So violence, in my opinion, it may get headlines. It may feel good. I understand it. I was on the fringe of that when I was a teenager. I had friends in the Weather Underground movement. An acquaintance, you know, just got out of jail at the end of the Clinton administration. I mean, I knew some of those folks. And they were not helping SDS, and they were not helping the movement. And looking back on it, they would be the first to tell you that. You know, you ask Bill Ayers today. So I don't think that's where it's going to go. I don't think that's where it's going to go, violent revolution. I know there are some people who say that that's the only way to do it, to tear the whole thing down, violent revolution. I don't think it's going to go there. And B, I don't think that there's going to be popular support for it. So, Kitty in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Kitty, what's up?
Tom, with what's been happening with the Occupy movement, I think it's going to be harder and harder to continue in public spaces. So what would you think about yard signs just in front of people's individual houses and condos or whatever all over the country, just everybody put a yard sign?
Well, this is where the Occupy movement adopting some kind of a logo would be a great idea, in my opinion. I can't tell them what to do. But the Tea Party adopted, basically as their logo, the old flag, the Don't Tread on Me flag, the flag with the snake on it was the original, one of the original flags of the American Revolution. And there are several other original flags of the American Revolution that have not been adopted by the Tea Party. And the Occupy Wall Street movement might want to look at some of those early flags, because if they had a logo like that, if there was a flag that was clearly, you know, just like the rainbow flag is the flag of gay rights, if there was a clear logo or symbol, then that would make your idea very, very easy to do. And it's a brilliant idea. And people could simply hang that flag or stick that sign in their front yard or in the front window of their house and say, I stand with the Occupy movement. Great idea, Kitty.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. Stick around. It's Tom Hartman, 45 minutes past the hour.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Oakland, Grandma in Oakland, California. Hey, you're on the air.
Yes. The mayor of Oakland is showing her incompetence by spending our tax money for attacking free speech.
I agree.
Instead of working with protesters so they can police themselves by removing violent fake protesters and removing texters from their group by helping the police identify these people who are hurting the movement.
I agree. And in fact, these kind of police actions that Gene Kwan is promoting actually further radicalize the movement and give credibility is the wrong phrase, but give power to, when you use violence, you give power to violence. And you know, violence always begets violence. It's why overthrowing. So it's why, you know, our going into Iraq and Afghanistan using violence is leading to violent governments. It's no way to
exactly.
Do things. So thank you very much for the call. Very, very well said, and very poignant actually when you think about it. Linda, can you pronounce your city in Oklahoma there, Linda, for me, please?
Quapaw.
Quapaw. Okay, great.
Yes.
What's up?
I was wanting to know, in the state of Colorado, they have free medical insurance for their residents. How would that possibly compare to what California is trying to do with this single pay?
I don't believe that Colorado has universal free health insurance. They may, you know, every state has their own version of Medicaid. In Vermont,
yeah.
It was called Dr. Dinosaur. It's free insurance for kids or for poor people. You know, I don't think Colorado is any different than any other state in that regard. Say what? Yeah.
It's their form of Medicare then.
Yeah, I believe so. I'll have to look into more detail on that, Linda. I'm, but
oh,
I, but
okay.
I know that that, you know, from my conversations with Bernie Sanders, who, you know, Vermont was the first state to pass legislation for free universal single payer health care. And that's Vermont. But you were saying Colorado, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And to the best of my knowledge, to the best of my knowledge in Colorado, it's not the case. Thank you for the call, though. And if I'm sure that somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not. Rick in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks. In Vermont, we have.
Hey, Rick, I can hardly hear you on the speakerphone. Can you pick up your phone?
Is that better?
Yeah.
Good. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I was just going to say that, you know, we have our own health care going in Vermont, but when I hear about California, I say, go California. But listen, that isn't why I called. Look, a while back, someone brought up the New World Order, and I just like to make a point in that respect, if I may, and that is that if you roughly define New World Order using the terms world and order, then I would say that probably means a direct or indirect control of the world by global economic interests.
Yes, and, I agree.
And
I think that's what George Bush meant, Friar George Herbert Walker Bush meant when he said that.
Yeah. I didn't realize that at the time, but he wasn't very specific. But the point I want to make is that the biggest obstacle to reaching such a goal is, I believe, a strong, and I underline strong, small d democratic United States of America.
Yes.
And that might be what accounts for what's been going on here and in other parts of the globe, but mostly here, for the last 10 to 30 years.
Oh, absolutely. The Reagan Revolution is nothing more than a revolution by the elites against the average American, against the American middle class.
The
takeover of the elites.
The point I want to make is not just that, a really democratic United States, but a strong democratic United States, which means that there, in my opinion, there indeed are powers working not just accidentally and for surely political reasons within the United States to bring down our economy, but in fact to make the United States weaker so that it is easier to change it for those ends. And
I agree with you, and I wrote a book making that argument called Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, Now We Can Fight Back.
I've been going to read that for a long time.
I'm totally with you, Rick. You've nailed it. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening there in Vermont. Connie, listening on K-Talk in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Connie, what's up?
Tom, I just wanted to let you know that a few months ago I called Benton Harbor about their park that's so beautiful, and they were going to, I'm sorry you caught me eating a bagel.
That's okay.
But they were going to take the park over
mm-hmm.
and have condos. And I want to tell you that as an old retired city clerk, I called up Benton Harbor and I told them to be sure and check their deed, because when people or companies deed property for parks, especially a long time ago, like in our city in 1909, Standard Oil deeded a lot of parks and the site for City Hall to the city, and they put in there perpetual,
right,
that it's deeded in perpetuity. And so with all that's going on back there and them taking over the city,
that is in that deed for that park mm-hmm. in Benton Harbor, according to the city commissioner that we had, or the city council member that we had on. And Rick Snyder has figured out some way in his legislation in Michigan to get around that. So, but we'll see, and I'm sure that there'll be a legal challenge. Connie, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for your activism and calling them up and speaking to them, one former city commissioner to another, or city clerk to another. Good on you. And thank you for calling the show. Coming up tomorrow, why are conservatives upset that the government is trying to make Americans healthier? I'll challenge Greg Beto of Reason Magazine on his latest argument, or his article, rather, Big Brother is now your diet coach.
Right.
And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.